Unselfishness is not just give and assist. Unselfishness is when you sacrifice yourself, and we give values to things that are good habits. And if one of them is the unselfishness or the commitment or team spirit, that means that the players must know which actions belong to that value.
Welcome to Slapping Glass, where we explore basketball's best ideas, strategies, and coaches from around the world. Today, we're excited to welcome the head coach of BC Andorra and Spain's ACB, Iban Navarro. Coach Navarro is here today to discuss preseason building blocks, running false motion, and we talk transition fouling and 4-on-4 during an always fun start, sub, or sit. A big thank you to the hundreds of coaches and staffs from around the world who've joined SG Plus this summer. Your support helps us continue to provide the highest quality content we can. Listeners of the podcast can receive 10% off the membership by entering the code SG10 at checkout. Visit slappingglass.com for more information on all that the membership entails today. And now, please enjoy our conversation with Coach Iban Navarro. Coach, thanks so much for making the time to come on and speak with us. We're really excited to have you.
Thanks to you guys. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here with you.
Appreciate that. Thank you. All right, Coach, a lot of stuff we're going to dive into today with you, and we're really excited to do so. But to start right now, as we're recording this, it's preseason for most of us. And it's sort of this time where, you know, all summer or spring after the season ended, you're learning new things, you're going to clinics, you're studying your team, and you've got all these ideas going into next season on things you may or may not do differently or the same from the year before. And so I wanted to talk about your preseason planning process and how you kind of go into that preseason, and specifically how you decide whether you're going to take something maybe brand new that you want to implement into your team, how you think about going to implement this brand new defense, offense, play, whatever it is for the season coming up.
The preseason starts right after the postseason, obviously. For me, it's very important when just before the summer, some organizations demand you to give a lecture or clinic. And I always want to give a lecture of different things, not something that I have already done. Because when you start to prepare something like this, that makes you think about how you want to do the things. And when you start to organize that, sometimes you already realize that you have done things that you don't like, or you have done things that you are not completely agree. This is the first step to make, let's say, an analyze of the season. Of course, there is a start analyze. There is an analyze also of the success of the sets, the transitions, not only the transition of the sets, but also the way they have finished, because maybe you have situations that you want to play for pick and roll and all of them finish with a one-on-one. Or so you have to make a global analyze, but also when you prepare those lectures, you realize that there are things that you have not done like you want to do. Then the first idea that we have when we start to build a team is to locate clearly the things that we can do better just changing players. Last season, for example, we had big handicap. We were one of the worst teams in spot up shots for three, very poor goals. So this was one of the issues that we have to improve for the next one. So we decide to bring players that for sure come from having better goals shooting from outside, even that brings decrease in our maybe athletic level or our defensive level. But at the end of the day, the market has offered us the possibility to keep both. I mean, to keep our athleticism and to improve those players' abilities about shooting from outside. This is one of the best things that we want to do. And you have to recognize how those players, or what they have done playing with their former teams, to have those goals. If it has been just with a spot up, if it has been playing ISOs to create their own shots or spot up or whatever. And you have to also see if that fits with your team, just to make all the pieces, all the puzzle fit, okay? And I would say that the third point is the one what we are right now, is to see which of the things that we have done the last season, we can keep them. Actually, we're going to keep 9 of the players of the last season. So we're going to try for sure to keep most of them, especially the most successful ones, and see how we can adjust all of them to the skills that those new players bring. So this is more or less our idea of the precision in terms of build a new one.
Coach, sticking on just your example of the spot up shooting, how much went into it, like you deciding we need better shooters versus we weren't generating the quality of shots for our shooters to succeed last season?
For sure, most of the spot up shots that we have, not all of them, of course, were really wide open shots. Also, we go to the generation source of those shots. I mean, I think that we play maybe too many pick and rolls with the idea of not scoring, but to creating with the not correct players. This is also an analysis that we have. For example, we have Jeremy Senglin playing too many pick and rolls. Actually, the success of those pick and rolls in terms of generate for the other ones was really poor, because at the end of the day, Jeremy is a player that first, he doesn't need the pick and roll to create his own shots. And he's not a player. He's a scorer, not a creator, a generator. About this, I like these things that the NBA is doing about not talk about point guards, shooting guards, forwards, centers, just about creators, like workers, okay, and finishers. One of the mistakes that we had was to put Jeremy in that role of creator when he was scorer. Mm-hmm. He suffered from this. So most of the spot up shots that we created from a pick and roll of Jeremy were not so clear and open shots. This is one of the first points. But that means that when we had some other ones, the pressure on the shooter to make them is too big.
Yeah.
And that's why there are two things: to have better shooters, but have better generators of those spot-up shots, especially here in Europe, that if you don't have a post-up player, you need to create some, most of the times, from screens or from pick and roll. We got both sources, but I mean, one of the mistakes that we had was to put Jeremy Senglin in that role of creator in pick and roll.
Yeah.
Coach, when going into your preseason planning as well, and the ACB is well known for having some of the best basketball coaches and players in the world, who do you study in the off season, or how do you get new ideas for your team? Is it, you know, looking at your own team from last year? Is it looking at other successful teams in the ACB? Who do you look at for ideas?
One of the lectures that I have to give in June was about an analysis of a scouting analysis of the 8 teams that play playoff. And I knew it, but it was great to put it on numbers. There were like 5-6 situations that at least 6 of them played. So that gives you some tips about what you can prepare during the preseason in terms of offense and defense to play against those teams, especially because the other 13 teams that didn't play playoff, most of them also played those situations. So this is one of the main issues, to identify things that if you have them prepared during the preseason, in terms of defense in this case, or you can save time when you face them during the season, because most of them play. And then a small difference between how, for example, Tenerife can play a situation, or Baskonia or Barcelona, they play the same, but with different focus, offensive focus. And where are the details of the entries, of the spacing, the initial spacing in the entries? It's interesting because you look in your teams, what kind of players like them you can have to adjust, not to copy, also to copy, but most of the times to adjust some of your sets or your motions to those situations because you got similar players.
Coach, I'd like to now kind of shift to now preseason on the court, and you're going to be in the gym with the guys. To start out, what is your approach as far as where do you start to build when you get into the gym with these guys?
I had a handicap in my career because I didn't go, let's say, from very low teams to bigger ones. I started on very big ones to go down. Okay, I was in Baskonia for many years, and then my first experience as head coach was in Baskonia, and then I went to Manresa 2 years, then Murcia. One of the main mistakes that I've made, and even sometimes I still do, is to take things by giving. I mean, you are with pro players and you consider they are very good players with great skills, talent, and you take by giving that they are able to know the things good. And sometimes this is one of the main mistakes that you have in precision, when you think that I don't have to explain my players how to play a pick and roll. All of them know how to play pick and roll. The first problem is that maybe they have not played pick and roll together.
Yeah.
So you have to create those cooperation. You have to create those relationships in the team, even from the two-on-two, even on the one-on-one on defense most of the times. And this is definitely one of the things that year by year I have been doing better. You know, like, we're going to start from the beginning. I remember one conversation I have with Thiago Esprit many years ago, and he explained with Coach Popovich that they started the first practicing with the Spurs with playing 1-on-0 on defense, 1-on-1, 2-on-0, 2-on-2, from this very small details. And from then on, day by day. And I think that is, first, if Coach Pop does it, maybe it's something that we have to, you know, to put in our mind.
Yeah.
But it's true, because maybe sometimes in 2-3 weeks, you detect that it's a problem and you don't know why they don't play this situation good. And it's because of the details. It's because of the details that you didn't focus in the first days. I also think that no matter the drills or the things that you do in the first, let's say, 5-10 practice, in those days, the most important thing is not what you do, but the habits that you force the team to get. For example, how you want to organize the offensive rebound, your defensive transition, how active you want them to have their hands on defense, how active you want to be on defensive transition in terms to go and trap the ball, or all these small things, no matter the drill, no matter if it's 2-on-2, 3-on-3, 4-on-4, no matter. Those habits must be got in the first days. Because if you put like 10, it's very difficult. I think that the top level coaches are able to keep those 10 habits. Lower ones, maybe we are able to keep 7, 6, but you have to be sure that those 6, 7s habits are the ones that are going to make you be the team that you want to be. It's like the DNA of the team.
Coach, hearing you talk about these habits, how important is being patient in the preseason as a head coach? And like, not moving on if, like you said, the guys aren't picking up the habits or they're not really in the 2-on-2 or the pick and roll. How important is to stay patient and trust the process rather than like, we got to move on and keep pushing forward when you should be maybe going backwards?
You have to find the balance between two things. First, that you have to find the athletic condition. I mean, you cannot give a clinic, a lecture in each practice and or each 2 minutes stop to, you have to find the balance between, let's make them get the rhythm that you need to play with, but don't forget those habits. Don't forget those small details. Okay. And of course, not all the practices are the same. You have to use the practice, maybe the not tape practice or after weights, for example, in the morning to come on the court and give importance to those details that in the evening you will not stop so often. Okay. But you're going to demand. There are practices that you have to be focused on athletic condition, on the rhythm, and on the details. Okay. All together is not so easy. This is why you get your assistant coaches to help you, of course. You gotta put the focus on 1-2 issues in each practice. If today we're gonna go on the details on how we want to play the pick and roll, or let's try to attack, reject the first in the pick and roll, or have patience to let the big man set the right screen or the right angle, don't attack too early, not to get the offensive foul, all these things. If those is the issue, go. Go and do it. But don't start to talk about rhythm, go, go, go. If that's the challenge, the goal of the practice, go for it. If the goal of the practice is, guys, we need to have rhythm, that day maybe you gotta ask the assistant coaches for those tasks to go individually. Remember, patient, set good screen, change the angle at the very last moment. But you gotta put the focus on what is really important on each practice.
Coach, just a specific question on preseason practices. How long, hour-wise, is a good preseason practice in your mind?
I hope my athletic coach will not watch this podcast. Here in Europe, minimum, we want to play next season 50, 52 games, minimum. For the next month is the typical battle, the typical war between the athletic coach and the head coach. You always think that you need more time. You always think that it's not enough. You think that you are late in your plan. And it's like you are pulling in one direction and he's pulling the other one. Like, have patience. They need to recover. The younger coach you are, the more, let's say, unconscious you are about this. Because when the time goes by and you are in February, March, April, you start to remember the energy, the gas that you spend in August, no? But of course, you know, this is professional. You need to win. This is not like, you know, in the past when you have to be good in February and you have to be good in May. If you are not good in September and October, maybe you are out in November.
Right.
I think that when you are getting older and you get more experience, also that gives you the confidence enough to trust on that process, to have patience, control. And it's also something that the players, if they get used to very long practices, then during the season it's very difficult for them to have so long practices and keep the intensity till the beginning.
Sure.
From the last 2 years, I started to put the time on the game clock in order to make them know how much time left we get.
Coach, speaking on, you said trusting the process. I'm curious, in the preseason, it's always going to be ugly. You know, like you said, guys are maybe a little out of shape. They're getting to know each other. Maybe it's new plays. I guess trusting the process in terms of how do you know when, okay, this is just the natural ugliness that comes with the preseason versus like, okay, maybe it's not going to work. How can you distinguish or differentiate between like, yeah, this is just the natural growing pains and this is like, okay, maybe we need to adjust this more or fix this?
Look, I think that maybe it's not the ugliest part of the season. And if it is, you have to show enthusiasm about it because you are building something that you have to transmit that this is going to be great and successful. This is very important. I told you about how important it is for me the chemistry. It's also very interesting to see the chemistry and this cooperating relationships between them, maybe between players that have not been playing together in the last season or new players or old ones to keep the, you know, this connection they have between them. It's very interesting because in one side, you got the human relationships and in the other one, you got the sport relationships. And from outside, sometimes it's like a good human relationships give you tips. That is something like you have to, you know, push in the sport part of you. I think that is not ugly. It's about people, about human. It's very interesting process. And about the other question, it's true. You gotta have patience. If you try to set something and it doesn't work, you cannot say this doesn't work. Let's put it off. Okay. Because sometimes you need to have patience about this, like you said. But for me, it's very important the feedback I get from the players. I like to ask them if they feel comfortable. I usually look for, especially for the new ones, things that they have done in the past that they liked it and it was successful for them in order to have something that is specifically for them that make it sometimes easy, the adjustment. Okay. I come here. I have to, you know, to settle down. I have to see the new things, but I have something that everybody knows is for me because everybody trusts on me to do it good because I did it in the past. And this is something that I like to do because it's the best way to involve new players in the system.
Coach, we wanted to transition a little bit from the preseason talk to now, you know, getting on the floor and some tactical stuff with you. And one of the things that your team and so many of the teams in the ACB do so well is run a lot of action, great motion into a ball screen or handoff or whatever it is that you're going to run. And so wanted to dig in on your philosophy on false motion or motion before the main action and how you go about trying to devise it and sort of just think about moving the pieces of the chessboard around before the main play.
I think that this is like a feedback cycle. As I told you, there are not too many different things that the teams play. At the end of the day, we can have similar sets to all of them, but there are also some small details. But when you make a scout or when you play watch games, you see how the coaches prepare the teams to those things. So that also makes you tips about what you can do about those defense. For example, the typical Spain pick and roll, you can recognize if there is a team that they always play like triple switch, or they go under also, or they are aggressive and they come from the last guy from the corner or whatever. And you put that in your mind to prepare things that attack, not what you want to attack, but the way they get to play defense on. And sometimes it happens that the same thing that you are doing, other coach also does it. So in meantime, you see how they also react to those defense. So it's also like, you know, like a chess, you know, battle. Like everybody is like, I know that you know that I know what you're going to do, and everybody's ready. But at the end of the day, it's sometimes we think that this is a battle between the coaches, but sometimes it's the players who take decision, or the players who read, are the players that sometimes making mistake do the things better. That is also that, because maybe you are expecting they play the defense that they have to, and one of them make a mistake, and that kills you because he is not where he has to be, you know? And at the end of the day, we cannot try to make basketball a coach game. It's players' game.
Coach, following up on the motion, that the chess piece, kind of like what you talked about, when you look at maybe adding motion or things like that to your offense, how much of it is just things that you believe personally are the best ways to attack a defense versus a scouting report and you're saying, okay, the team's going to drop in coverage or they're going to hedge, and so we're going to, you know, add something to attack that specifically?
I think that, of course, it's like NBA or not so like in the NBA, but you don't have too much time to adjust many things between games. So in preseason, you kind of prepare your team to play against different kind of defense in pick and roll, about different kind of defense off screens situations, to make it easy to get at the game and say, guys, today we're going to play against hedge defense or against flat defense, or we're going to have a deny defense on off screens. So it's like you refresh the tools that you taught them during the preseason. Today, it's we play against deny defense and hedge. Because if during the game it changes, it's in a timeout, you cannot be also able to, guys, react. The defense has changed. We cannot change also our idea. So it must be quickly. The base of those jobs is in preseason, to prepare the game, the team to play against any kind of defense. The adjustment, okay, yeah, when you're going to play like King's Cup or playoff, it's something more specific. But during the season, when you don't have too much time to prepare, like usually happens, must be very quickly.
You mentioned earlier when you're doing the scouting, the analysis and the entries and the spacing that other teams have. I'd like to hear your thoughts on how you look at entering the offense and spacing. You know, we looked at your offense last year. You had a lot of horns actions and then some stagger aways. But how do you look at how you want to enter the offense and kind of the initial formation?
For me, it's very important to see how early or how late the opening team start to play defense. Because there are teams that just run back to play a defensive transition, collapse the paint, and then they start to play defense. Or there are other teams that they start to play defense right away and they put pressure on you on backcourt, and that makes you play, force you to play really far from the rim. For example, against those kind of teams that play very aggressive, we decide not to play too many entries of double high. Because if you do it, most of the times you start to play 10 meters distance from the rim, and it's not really effective to do it. So in those cases, we prefer to, you know, to start with the players closer to the baseline, or if we don't have too much time, go to a simple action. If we play a far pick and roll with a, you know, like a flat angle to attack with the speed. But what decides what to play or which entries we're going to play is how early or how late the opponent team start to play defense.
Okay.
I wonder about how you, whenever you, however you decide, let's say horns entry or whatever it is, how you like to rep those out in practice and how you like to practice those, whether it's a 5-on-0, 5-on-5, or do you like to break things down drill-wise, in order to get your guys, like you mentioned in the preseason, ready for whatever the defense may throw at them? Your thoughts on getting those good repetitions in?
Something that I learned from my 9 years of as assistant coach with different head coaches is that I don't like to use 5-on-0 to warm up, because you cannot demand the team to go full speed if you are warming up. And then when you are playing, you want them to go full speed. No? So it got no sense. It's like you go against yourself. You know? Usually for the warm up, we use, you know, like many shooting drills or parts of your offense in terms of be focused on some details. But when I do 5-on-0, usually I do it full speed. And there is another detail that I don't like to make things like I play on half court one set, and right after the shot, I run opposite. When you shoot, you don't attack on opposite side.
Right.
When you shoot, you play defensive transition. So this is also like when we talk about habits, my habit is that when I play 5-on-0 one set, the offensive team got the habit to go with 3 or 4 guys, depending on which situation we are, to the offensive rebound, and 1 or 2 guys play defensive transition. And it's the other team who grab the rebound, take it out from baseline if it's basket or not, and run. Because of their habits, you know?
Sure, yeah.
If you are focused on the habits of offensive rebound and de-transition, and you start to play 5-on-0, and they run opposite side the same offense, this is not basketball real reality.
Right.
You know? So yeah. I try to be everything like connected.
Makes sense.
Coach, transition offense, do you assign lanes? We want a rim runner, we want a trailer every time, or is it more free-flowing and however we transition up the court kind of will play out of concepts?
Look, my experience is that when you have transitions and you want your team to play transition and they run into the transition. I mean, the players are running, thinking on going to the right spot to play the transition. So you lose the aggressiveness that you can have on open court. So I changed the idea, not in such successful way last season, I have to admit, but my idea is that let's run, guys. Let's run full speed. Let's try to be aggressive, and let's give the right space into the ball handlers to be aggressive and try to go all the way. But if we can't, let's try to link with the next step, like the next offensive gear, in this case, the transition, depending on how we run. And for us, no one of our fours were post-up players. So we always try with trying to run with them in the opposite side corridor of the lane from the ball, okay? And then have him all open on the corner on opposite side. But if he runs on the same side of the ball, we keep him on the corner. So that's what decide what kind of transition we can play after. If we get the four, playing position four, in the same side of the ball, or we cut it running the lane and finishing on opposite side. In depending on that, we jump into one or other transition. That was what decided the last season. This one, it's something that we are analyzing because we get 1-4 that can post up.
Yeah.
So we have to decide if we're going to have different ways of running or just one given to both players in position four to go to the low post. And this is something that we have to analyze what we're going to do. But usually what decides one thing or another is how the four runs.
Okay. And then with your five, is it usually a post five? So he's going to be rim running most of the time, or is it again, depending on his skill set, if he's not a post player, is he going to run, you know, space?
Last season, our fives were not low post players till the arrival of Artyom Parachowski. When he arrived, we changed a little bit the idea and we look for him sometimes in early low post situations. But before that, our fives were pick and roll players and very quick players. So sometimes they were the first trailer running the lane and we look for them. If they were the first one and they didn't post up, what we look for is to play pick and roll, setting the screen angle towards the baseline. And with players like Pauli, Sengling, Hanna, and Seti Garcia, that provided us a lot of situations with the ball handler attacking with the speed against the five.
Yeah.
No, but we didn't post up. They were not low post players.
With that, the drag screen or the five-man setting the screen to the baseline, more and more teams are running it. I guess, what is the advantage you think you're looking to create, or running that screen as opposed to the traditional drag screen to the middle?
For me, the key is the position of the defensive five.
Okay.
Because when you set that kind of screen with the big men in a static situation, with the big men coming from the baseline, what you can find most of the times is this like blue eyes, deny the middle defense. But in transition, it's very difficult for the fives on defense to protect the baseline, to protect the line ball rim. And that's why with good slashers players or even with good shooters off bounds, this is a very dangerous and suspenseful situation because the big man is not in time where he has to be in that kind of angle screens.
Coach, we're going to transition now into a segment that we call Start, Sub, or Sit here on the podcast. So it's a lot of fun. We give you three different basketball topics and you'll say which one you would start, sub, and then sit, and then we'll briefly talk about it. So we've got a few here for you, and we want to start with fouling, and has to do with teaching or not teaching when to foul and where to basically spend your time in, so let's say the preseason, teaching these fouling or not fouling concepts. So start, sub, or sit, teaching the transition foul, how to make sure you give a foul in transition without it being a penalty, teaching not fouling on a shooter, like at a closeout, or teaching not fouling at the rim, teaching how to wall up, jump straight up, and not foul someone attacking the rim. So those three scenarios, start, sub, or sit.
This is a very, very tough question. I would start to tell you my philosophy about the fouls. For me, there are three kind of fouls. The one that you spend on purpose, not to let the opponent team create advantage. The one that you spend to kill the advantage. Once the advantage has been created, you spend one foul to stop that advantage. And the other ones, the ones that you make because you are trying to play one-on-one or close out or whatever. I think that these first two kind of fouls are good ones for me, especially when you are not in bonus, of course. And we give value to the players that decide to make those fouls with intention of limit the advantage or stop the advantage. Then we work about the closeout situations on shooters in terms of not going, you know, in front against the shooter, but run and against players that you got clear that are shooters and your priority is to force them to put the ball on the floor. And at the very last moment, we don't jump to contest the shot, but we go slides, lateral slides to be on his side of the shooting hand. So we run, and at the very last moment, instead jump, we go by his side, close to the shooting arm, you know, with the hands up.
Yeah.
That's something that I learned from Brad Oleson that was great doing this, very, very smart. And it's a way to contest the shots to the shooters that limit the possibility for them to use the legs looking for this contact that sometimes the referee calls fouls. Finally, in defensive transition, we get the philosophy on not fouling, but always try to play the ball in terms of try to put the body to get charged. Can happen two things. You get it or it's foul. But anyway, you are trying to play the ball. Because if you want to play foul, you're going to use the hands. And then you got more than 50% of possibilities to be called on a sportsmanlike foul. But if you try to put your body to get a charge and there is a contact on your body, the referee, first, he has to decide if it's offensive foul or defensive foul. But if he got that question, the second one doesn't exist.
Right.
They cannot have the doubt of it was offensive or defensive foul. If they got that doubt, they got not the second one. It was unsportsmanlike foul. If you were thinking about if it was offensive or defensive, how is it possible that you call unsportsmanlike foul? So we always try to put the body. And maybe you have watched those players that in transition, when the ball is on the side and they are in the middle lane, they are looking for the body of the big guys, running, looking the ball, okay, trying to be on their way to get the contact. And we don't, I don't like this.
Sure, sure.
I don't like this. I think that is, you know, it's tricky, it's smart, but for me, it's not basketball.
Yeah.
When one player, that, I got one player that usually does it, and, you know, the coach is always like, celebrate it, but I don't push them to do it because I don't like it.
Coach, I have a follow-up about fouling to stop the creation, the advantage creation. I just would like to know maybe more, elaborate more on like, what's the line between, you know, because obviously you have help and rotations also, and you don't want to be over-reliant on, then we just foul right away and getting into trouble. I guess what to you is like, that's a good foul because he's going to create the advantage. That's like, well, let's play it out. We have the help. We don't need the foul there.
Let's say, to put a couple of examples, for me, the foul that you spend going very strong with your body in a pick and roll in transition with a very good ball handler, stopping that pick and roll in transition with when you don't have your defense organized behind, it's a way to not let the opening create an advantage. When they play that pick and roll and they get rid of it and they start to punish your rotation system and you spend a foul, that's the way you have to stop the advantage.
Yeah.
The advantage is created. It's like, very simple example. There is a mismatch. And when the ball goes inside, or even when the ball is in the air going inside, the small guy make a foul on the big one. You don't let the advantage is being created. But if the ball is inside, you go to trap and they pass the ball outside and you spend the foul on that rotation of the ball, that's the way you have to stop. I don't know if I explain myself. Because sometimes the player is that has to spend the foul not to let them create, can get foul trouble. He doesn't foul, but we cannot know it, and we have to react that in the moment he gets rid of it, we gotta spend the foul later to stop the rotation. Or, for example, when you get not a mismatch, when you get a small forward playing on the post against a big one, but it's the right match, how many times we see that one team see an advantage, they pass the ball inside, you spend a foul, and they don't do it again.
Sure.
A lot of times.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, they found it. But they quit. They don't do it anymore because it's like, we're going to pass the ball inside and they're going to foul. Yes?
Right.
And they don't do it. So sometimes you have to play with it. If they are smart, maybe they do again. But most of the times, after the foul, they quit.
Implementing this fouling kind of idea in practice, because I know too, there's times where coaches, you know, they don't like the fouls or like, you know, hey, let's play it out. We want to rep. So how do you build this in practice so you guys can execute in the games and you know the scenarios, you know the situations where you want to give these fouls?
Like I told you before, we give values to things that are good habits. For me, those situations that means a minus one in the index for the teams, for the players on the stats, like spend these kind of fouls, these kind of things that are minus one, mm-hmm. We try to give the right value during the practice and we try to make all the team know that we give a lot of value for this.
Okay.
This links also with values of the team, the values that the players bring to the team. Each player got, these are my values and these are the values that I bring to the team. And when you put all of them, you find that the team have some values. And if one of them is the unselfishness, or the commitment, or team spirit, that means that the players must know which actions belong to that value. Mm-hmm. Unselfishness is not just give an assist. Unselfishness is when you sacrifice yourself and you got minus one in your index, but you limit one advantage. Because at the end of the day, maybe you are stopping one easy basket and you won by one at the end of the game. So this is what we try to transmit to the players, that which actions in the game are related on the values that we have decided that the team has. You know, this is also related with team chemistry that I told you before. We try to have everything connected, okay, and create like a team alliance of how we want to face some situations or how we want to, the value that we want to give or to some situations that means commitment and selfishness and team spirit.
So coach, just judging from your answer, you would probably start transition fouling. You would sub the closeout and sit the wall up.
No, I don't know.
Or they're all good.
Yeah, all of them are good, you know.
Yeah.
It's not easy, but this is what I'm telling you guys here, like August 6th. But when the dance starts, everything changes. You know?
That's right.
This is like this. And I think that is also human to know that everything must not be under very, not common sense, but everything is decided previously in terms of I have think about this too long and I have decided to do the last thing. During the game, in the same way the players got this flow sometimes, okay? Yeah. Also, the coaches got this like intuitions to see something that maybe you're wrong, maybe not, but you see something. You know your team better. Also, your assistant coach are watching the same. You talk a lot. You know the opponent. And sometimes you have to let it go.
Yeah.
You know, let it flow it and take decisions that maybe are against what you have decided in the game plan, but you see something that makes you change your mind suddenly and go in another direction. Usually when it works, it's like brilliant. And when it doesn't work, it's like, I'm stupid. I went against my own game plan. I'm stupid. But this is part of the game.
Yes.
You
know?
Yeah. All right, coach. Well, our next start sub, Sid, we're going to put you in a defending a late game middle pick and roll. And this question kind of arose out of watching Luka in the Olympics. So you're going to be defending a complete point guard, able to pass, score. So you're on defense defending it. Start, sub, sit. Would you switch against it? Would you trap it? Or would maybe you drop into a zone or like a box and one?
Give me the number of the point guard. Patrick Mills, Doncic is completely different.
Yeah.
For me, it's very important. The key is sometimes is not how good one player is scoring, but how one player good is in passing the ball. Because this is something that I have think a lot, you know. When you play pick and roll and the defense is very aggressive, the defense is aggressive because they want you to get rid of it. So the way that you have to attack that pick and roll defense is get rid of it. So it's like what the defense wants you to do, it's exactly what you do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and this kind of stupid things that the coaches got in our mind, you know, like what they want me to do, this. And this is exactly what I do. So their defense work, you know. I think that depending on the player, I think that one good option could be switch. If you got like Rudy Gobert, for example, maybe you don't need to do anything. It's like, okay, score 1-on-1 against Rudy Gobert. Let's see if you are able to do it. But if he's able to do it or you don't have Rudy Gobert, maybe you have to do something to make him pass the ball. If you consider that he is more dangerous scoring 1-on-1 in a mismatch than passing the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Or how good are the other players? You cannot cover everything. If you are sure that what you want to cover is that mismatch, maybe what you have to go to do is blitz on that mismatch and force him to pass the ball and rotate. And let's make other one take that shot, open shots. Or maybe what you have to do is trap. If he wants to pass the ball to the short roll to the big man and the big man cannot that shot range, or he's limited to pass the ball, or he's like a 7-foot guy and he's not able, you know, skillful to get that short roll pass, go with those two dribbles and dunk. You have to find what you're going to give them. If the first point is force him to pass the ball, okay, now what you're going to give them? No, this is what makes me decide if I trap, switch and blitz, or I switch and I keep the 1-on-1. Also the moment of the game, if it's the last off defense or, you know, there are a lot of things that have to make you take one decision or another.
And following up on it, will you ever maybe drop into a zone or, like I said, maybe a box and one where, you know, maybe to confuse the ball handler a little bit more? Are you more, let's play it with, like you said, a trap or a switch?
I have done it, not here, but I have done it. And I think that is something that you can use eventually, but it's not something that you have to do every time. Okay. I have done, for example, to jump in a 2-3 zone, but at the end of the day, it's like flat defense with your big man really deep.
Yeah.
With this next defense from the next guy. You know, it's like, okay, you jump in zone. Yeah, but at the end of the day, the 2-3 defense, zone defense is like if you play like drop defense and you come with the next one, like in the next defense. So there is not big difference between one thing or another, you know? Huh. Also, for example, I think there is a big discussion here in Spain about the game against Slovenia when Coach Scariolo decided to play this box and one at Doncic. I think that it was brilliant. That, okay, you are in the second half, Slovenia get used to attack this, and Luka keep on passing the ball. And he got like 17 assists. And, you know, Spain lost, and everybody say like, that's why they didn't change the defense. You have to change the defense, and you have to go in deep. Yeah, but if you change the defense and you play box on one, and now you let Doncic score, and he scored for sure because he got quality, and you lose, you went against your game plan.
Right.
Yeah.
These are the decisions that you gotta have, you know? You keep your game plan because you trust on it, your team trust on it, and you decide how they can beat you. Okay, guys, you can beat me with Chanchar scoring 6 threes, with Dimitri's offensive rebounds, but you will not beat me with you, Doncic, scoring 48 points.
Right.
You will not. This is how you have to decide.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I like it. I like it.
One other follow-up I have for you, Coach, and I want to go back when you said that you're going to trap and you want the ball handler to pass it, and the offense does that. I guess putting on kind of now looking at from the offensive end, if you want to keep the ball in the hands of your point guard, you know, you want to try to create with him and you know they're going to trap, what are some of the ways you'll maybe try to manipulate the screen or maybe some tactics you'll use so you can keep the ball in your point guard's hand and allow him still try to create?
One of the ideas that we have on offense is try to anticipate the defense in order to anticipate the advantage. I mean, if you know, if my point guard knows that he's going to be trapped, he has to be connected with the big man. And when they are about to suffer that trap, just in the previous second, we slip the pick and we don't attack the pick. And just doing it without dribbling, don't dribble it immediately when you get the ball. Let the big man comes. And when they are, like we said, like a chess game. Okay, we are here, guys, 2-on-2. Let's see who's the first that's going to move. If I dribble first, okay, maybe I'm going to lose because you're going to trap me. But if at that moment you got less patience than me and the big men jump early, now you lose because you anticipate the defense. I'm ready to do your defense and I look the big men in the sleep. So this is the first idea that we have to, like, they are scared of our pick and roll. They trap, then we quit. So you are doing what they want.
Yeah.
Well, let's try to find a way to attack what we want against your defense. But obviously, when you need to breathe or to air and or to dynamite the game, you have to play different situations like off screens or maybe a low post. And, you know, these low post rules with these moves on screens when the ball is inside or not inside, close to the baseline, but also close to the corner to have good pass angles to see everything. You got to have different ways to attack. But definitely, we don't quit when defense is aggressive in against our pick and roll. Because if you do it, it's like you give the defense what they want.
Yeah.
You don't play anymore. If it's a weapon that you have that is hurting them, you cannot quit it.
Yeah,
absolutely. Coach, we got one more start, sub, sit. Instead of playing 5-on-5, other situations to teach some sort of concept out of. So start, sub, sit, playing 4-on-4, playing 3-on-3, or playing 2-on-2, which one of those scenarios do you enjoy the most to teach from?
As I told you before, I think that on offense, I'll go from 2-on-2 to the 5-on-5, but there's more details about the patience, the reads of the defense. Sometimes we do it without defense. It's like, okay, guys, if we call 1, the defense is denied. If we call 2, the defense is trailed. If we call 3, the defense go under at the very last, go through at the very last moment. I'm talking about off screens, off ball screens. And then we get them used to go against 1, 2, 3. They know we give them the tools, okay, about what I have to do against 1. 1 means deny. What do I have to do against 2? 2 means trail defense. And then we start to change, okay? Okay, we start and we say 1. And at the very last moment, we say 2. And they have to react. This is the first step in 2-on-0. Then we go in 2-on-1 and we don't call 1, 2, 3. The defense play 1, 2, or 3. So they have to react. Then we go in 2-on-2 with some pressure on the passer. Okay. And from then on, we go to 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 5-on-5 with different situations. But on defense, I don't like talking about off-ball screens, low post, pick and roll. I usually do 4-on-4 situations because an off-ball screen or a pick and roll is not 2-on-2 anymore. It's minimum is 4-on-4.
Mm-hmm.
So we always work on those situations in 4-on-4 and 3-on-3. Sometimes 3-on-3, just on off-ball screens with the defense, with the screener, or with the screen guy, the shooter. Just 3-on-3, we limit it to that situation. For the other ones, it's minimum 4-on-4. Because there are always situations, positions on the weak side that are key of how we want to play defense on the focus. and you cannot skip them, because that creates sometimes frustration. If you make 3-on-3 and who has to help on one situation is on opposite side, but he is not on the court, sometimes that creates frustration. Even though you say, okay, guys, no matter, we got two more guys there. Yeah, but they have been scored. And they say, yeah, but once again, they score. And if they are competing and you want them to be competitive in the practice, that creates frustration. So minimum is 4-on-4 always.
Okay. With the 4-on-4, and I like what you said about the two guys on the help side communicating about backside coverages. I know playing live 4-on-4, but are there any drills or any things that you do to really help those guys on the backside communicate who's maybe tagging a role or who's getting out on shooters? How do you work with those guys?
Usually for us, it's very important the skills of the back screener, if he's a shooter or not. Because I think that the right defensive position of the back screener on the weak side, it's really far from the back screener. So if he's a shooter and the big man and the back screen's defender is in the right defensive position and he pops, you are late. So what decide how we want to play defense is if the back screener is shooter or not. If he's shooter, we switch.
Okay.
Always. Mm-hmm. If he's not a shooter, we trail the shooter and the big man keep his defensive position. If the back screener pops and he gets the ball, we got to run to go to the next action defense, maybe a handoff or whatever. But we are not treated by his three-point shots, let's say.
Yeah.
So that's what define how we want to play defense.
Okay. Well, Coach, you're off the start, sub, sit, hot seat, that segment. Thank you for going through those scenarios with us. We've got one more kind of wrap-up question here for you. But before we do, thanks really for coming on this morning, or this morning for us, this afternoon for you, and taking time and talking through this. Has been really fun for us. So thank you for your time.
It has been an honor for me. I think that, as I told you before, what you do, guys, is great, not only for basketball lovers, also for coaches. You know, the times are changing, and there are a lot of guys, young guys, that prefer to see clips on social network that are live. And you make this got sense, you know, because instead games, they look YouTube and they look, you know, Twitter and all these things. And you are a big part of keep the basketball alive with these young generations. And your job is very, very special and very useful for us, guys. Thanks.
Thank you, Coach. We appreciate that. We'll get you out of here on this question. We know that off the court, you're someone that's involved in helping coaches. You're the head of one of the labor unions for coaches in Spain, and you do a lot of work in that realm. I'm wondering what kind of advice that you give to younger coaches when thinking about how to have good work-life balance, how to progress in their coaching career, how to make their way like you have into the types of jobs that, you know, they can stay in for a long time and be successful at.
Wow. Let me say that I'm still a young coach. I got no super experienced coach, and I'm still learning nothing. And I hope that I will do it till the last day that I'm in this job. But one of the tips that I would give them is that first, you need to be definitely in the right moment, in the right place. So you need luck, because there are a lot of people that have got big knowledge. They are super prepared for this job. They got talent, but they don't have the chance, because at the end of the day, there are not so many places. But that doesn't mean that they have to quit. Okay? If you don't have that luck, you have to look for it. And day by day, we see that, like, many coaches are making the package and the flight and going to different places. So this is a way to enjoy not only your job, but also your life, doing what you love. And then you don't never know if that's going to give you in the future the chance to do it in the next level. And the other thing that I would say is that do things that you believe on, believing that you will do it when you get at that level. If you think that you have to be one way, no matter the age or the level that you are coaching, you have to be like this always. Because if you think that you have to be like demanding, let's say demanding, or you have to be more psychologist coach, there are a lot of different kind of coaches. But don't be that way that you believe you have to be when you arrive to that way. Maybe to arrive on that level, you have to be that way from the beginning. And this is something that when I speak with a lot of coaches, I hear a lot of times they say, no, I will be like this when I arrive. maybe you will not arrive if you are not like this from it, because this is how you are. Oh. You are like this. And you cannot lie the basketball and you cannot lie the players. You cannot be an actor. If you are like this, you're going to be like this always. And in the most stressful moments, your real yourself is going to come up. I'm going to show up. Be loyal to yourself and be like this always. Don't be like this when you think that you're going to be on the highest level, because maybe you will not arrive on that level. This is, you know, something that I like to speak about with them, because I'm young. I'm not talking about I'm 60 years old and I'm talking with coaches like I'm 30. There is not that different of age, but I understand them because I have been in that position sometimes, not too far ago. And I think this is one of the mistakes that they do. Wait for that moment to start to be like this. I'm working for this coaches community here in Spain, and we are trying to get agreements with the ACB to dignify this job, because sometimes we think that the big coach is being head coach. And day by day, we see that on the benches, there are like not one assistant coach, not two assistant coaches. We see three or four, because the quantity of tasks and the quality that are demanding of those tasks, day by day, are huge. And there are a lot of tools, there are a lot of things that you have to control about stats, video, psychologies. There are a lot of things. So there are four, because three are 120%. And you bring the fourth one and they are 110%. So we have to dignify. Sometimes the salaries of those guys is not good.
Sure.
It's people that love the basketball, love this job, and they are absolutely underpaid. And that killed the motivation, the love, the illusion that they have, the excitement they have for this sport. Because, okay, usually they are guys like that, like 20, 25 years old. They don't have family. But those guys grow up, settle down, got families, and they cannot keep in that position. And they quit. And they lose great professionals. We lose people with great talents for the basketball because of this. And this is something that we are really focused here. We gotta put those guys into the agreement. They have to be right paid. They have to be respected. Their job conditions must be good ones. The clubs must provide a laptop. Why an assistant coach have to put their laptop and start to travel with the laptop all around Europe? And you see how they are, you know, like working on the floor in a gate to get the next flight. And maybe they drop the laptop, it gets broken, and they have to put money. It's like a lot of things that we have to protect those things, because they are the future for sure.
Coach, you bring up a really important point. It's a tough job. Like you said, people may have to travel and the pay isn't good and it's a lot of hours. Those coaches trying to come up, what advice would you give to them in terms of, you know, what are ways young coaches can help themselves to better their future and other coaches' futures?
For me, the engine that moves those people is the passion. The passion is everything. So those guys are fed by passion for basketball, but there is one moment that the passion is not enough.
Yeah.
Your passion for the basketball doesn't feed your family, you know? And this is like what we have to protect. But I would say that as long as you have that passion and that moves you, that's your dream, you gotta fight for it. I remember that when I was like 29 years old, I have a very good job, very good job. Not about basketball. And, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, I have practice 8:30. And those 4 days when the clocks sounds 6 in the morning, the way I woke up was one. And Tuesday was another one. So that gives you like signals of what really moves you in your life. That happened to many people. And some of them, like me, got the luck during their life to pick up one of these jobs. And some others don't have, you know, they have to fight for the dream. As long as their obligations let them do it, they have to fight for the dream, because you never know in which moment, where, who with, or when gonna happen. But that chance gonna come. And if it comes, you gotta be ready. Because if it comes and you are not ready, because of you are not prepared in terms of speaking English or being able to cook, because maybe you have to go by your own to a foreign country but you don't know how to live on your own. Whatever those small details sometimes decide if you're going to take that chance or you don't. If the possibility comes, you got to be ready in all the aspects, not only in basketball, but in all the aspects. They have to be ready. They have to know. Big coach is not just know about basketball. It's know about people, relationships, athletic coach, but also about what lives by your own lonely means. So be ready. The chance doesn't come, at least you're going to be ready to live a better life.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode with Coach Ibon Navarro. Please make sure to check out slappingglass.com for more information on the free newsletter, videos, and the Slapping Glass Plus membership. Have a great week, coaching, and we'll see you next time on Slapping Glass. Do we have a name yet for this thing? I have like slapping backboard.
Slapping glass.
Slapping glass. That's kind of funny.
I like that. That's good. Let's roll. Slapping glass.